echoed. "I am in search of Dr. Hunter. I have an important message for him." The doctor blinked, took off his glasses and squinted at William, then put them back on and took up his knife again.
"He's at Jockey Hollow today," he said, "probably at the Wick House, but might be among the cabins."
"I thank you, sir," William said, meaning it. The doctor nodded absently and beckoned to the next in line. Another inquiry sent him uphill to Jockey Hollow, a rather mountainous area. Washington was damned fond of mountains, where a scene of immense devastation spread before him. It looked as though a meteor had struck a woodland, shattering trees and churning the soil. The Continentals had cut down what had to be at least 1,000 acres of trees. The stumps poked ragged fingers out of the mud, and bonfires of discarded branches smoked throughout the camp, each one with a fringe of soldiers holding out frozen hands to the heat. Logs were piled everywhere in a rude order, and William saw that, in fact, sizable cabins were being built. This clearly was going to be a semi-permanent encampment, and not a small one. Soldiers, mostly in plain dress or with army greatcoats, swarmed like ants. If Denzel was in there, it would take no little time to winkle him out. He walked up to the nearest bonfire and nudged his way into the circle of men around it.
God, the heat was wonderful.
"Where is the Wick House?" he inquired of the man next to him, rubbing his hands together to help spread the delicious warmth.
"Up there."
The man, a very young man, perhaps a few years younger than William, jerked his chin, indicating a modest-looking house in the distance on the crest of a hill. He thanked the boy and regretfully left the fire, smelling strongly of smoke. The Wick House, despite its modest size, was plainly the property of a wealthy man. There was a forge, a grain mill, and a sizable stable nearby. The wealthy man was either a rebel or had been forcibly evicted, for there were regimental flags planted near the door and a blue-nosed sentry outside, clearly there to weed out unwelcome visitors. Well, it had worked once. William put his shoulders back, lifted his head, and walked up to the door as though he owned the place. "I have a message for Dr. Hunter," he said. "Will I find him here?" The sentry gave him a look from rheumy, bloodshot eyes.
"No, you won't," he said. "May I inquire where he is, then?"
The sentry cleared his throat and spat, the gob of mucus not quite landing on the toe of William's boot.
"He's inside, but you won't find him there because I'm not letting you in. You've got a message? Give me it."
"It must be given into the doctor's hands," William said firmly, and reached for the doorknob. The sentry took 2 steps sideways and stood in front of the door, musket held across his chest and his blue nose forbidding in its righteousness.
"You aren't a coming in, friend," he said. "The doctor's with Brigadier Bleeker, and he's not to be disturbed."
William made a low sound that wasn't quite a growl. It didn't affect Blue Nose, though, and he tried again.
"What about Mrs. Hunter? Is she in camp, perhaps?"
God, he hoped not. He glanced over his shoulder at the sprawling mess below.
"Oh, aye, she's in there."
The sentry jerked a thumb backward, indicating the house.
"With the doctor and the brigadier."
"The brigadier, that would be..."
"General Bleeker. General Ralph Bleeker."
William sighed.
"Well, if I can't go in, would you be so kind as to go inside and tell her that her cousin has come with a message for her husband? She can come out and get it, surely."
It nearly worked. He could see doubt warring with duty on the man's face, but duty won, and Blue Nose doggedly shook his head and waved a hand.
"Shoo!"
William turned on his heel and did so. He strode down the hill, not looking back, and turned aside as soon as the growth of shrubs and small trees hid him from the sentry's view. It took no little while to circle the hilltop and make his way carefully up through the grain mill, but he was able to blend in with the people waiting there to have their flour ground, and could easily see the house. Yes, there was a back door, and no, glory be to God, there was no sentry, at least not right this moment. He waited until the small crowd had stopped noticing him and stepped away in the half-furtive manner of a man going for a piss.
quick, past the forge and up to the door, and in. He closed the back door behind him with a surge of pleasure.
Sir?
He turned round, finding himself in the kitchen and the cynosure of the gaze of a cook and several kitchen maids. The air was perfumed with the smell of roasting meat. There was a huge pig turning on the spit in the spacious hearth, and his mouth was watering. But food could wait. He bowed and lifted his hat briefly to the cook.
Your pardon, ma'am. I've a message for the doctor.
Oh, he's in the parlour,
said one of the younger maids. She looked admiringly up at William's body, and he smiled at her.
I'll take you.
Thank you, my dear, he said,
and bowed ingratiatingly again before following her out. The house was comfortable, but it seemed to have quite a few people in it. He could hear voices and the sound of footsteps overhead. There was a second story over the back part of the house. The maid led him to a closed door and bobbed a curtsy. He thanked her again, and as he reached for the porcelain knob of the door, he heard the unmistakable sound of his cousin Dotty's gurgling laugh, and his own face broke into a grin. He was still wearing the grin when he stepped into the room. Dotty was sitting in a chair by the fire, some sort of knitting on her lap, her face full of lively attention as the man in continental uniform standing by the hearth said something to her. Denzel was there, too, by the window, but William scarcely noticed, frozen to the spot by the sound of the man's voice.
William!
Dotty exclaimed, dropping her knitting. The man by the hearth turned sharply.
Jesus Christ, he said, staring in shock. What the devil are you doing here?
The blue of his coat gave his winter pale blue eyes a piercing glint. William felt as though he'd been kicked in the stomach by a mule, but managed a breath.
Hello, Ben, he said flatly.
Chapter 104. General fucking Bleaker. Ben looked at him with a cold formality and said, That would be General Bleaker to you, sir. That might have been taken as humour, but it bloody wasn't. It wasn't meant to be.
Bleaker?
William said, making it almost a question.
All right, if you must. But Ralph?
Ben's face darkened, but he kept his temper.
It isn't Ralph, he said shortly. It's Rafe.
One of Ben's names is Raphael,
Dotty said pleasantly, as though making conversation over the tea table.
After our maternal grandfather. His name is Raphael Wattiswade.
Is?
William said, startled into looking at her. I thought your mother's father was dead. He switched the look back to his cousin.
For that matter, I thought you were dead.
Dotty and Denzel exchanged a brief marital look.
I believe friend Wattiswade has gone to some trouble to give that impression,
Denzel said, carefully not looking at Ben.
Will thee sit down, William? There is some wine.
Without waiting for an answer, he rose and gestured to his empty chair, going then to fetch a decanter from a small table near the door. William ignored both the invitation and the chair. Ben was slightly taller than his father, but he was still 6 inches shorter than William. And William was not sacrificing the advantage of looking down on him. Ben stiffened, glaring up at him.
I repeat, what the devil are you doing here?
I came to find your sister, William replied, and gave Dotty a slight bow.
Your father wants you to come back to Savannah, Dotty.
Now that he'd a chance to look at her, he thought Uncle Hal had been right to want that. She was very thin, with dark circles under her eyes. Her dress hung on her bones, and overall she looked like a fine piece of china with a crack running through it and a chip out of the edge.
I told thee thee shouldn't have written to him,
she said reproachfully to Denzel, who'd handed her a glass of wine, and seeing that William was not about to accept the other one, sat down and took a sip from it himself.
And I told thee that thee should go home,
Denzel replied, though without rancour.
This is no place for any woman, let alone one who...
He caught sight of Dotty and stopped abruptly. A hectic flush had risen in her cheeks, and her lips were pressed tight. William thought she might either burst into tears or brain Denzel with the poker which was near at hand. Even odds, he concluded, and turned back to Ben, who had gone white round the nostrils. "Step outside with me," William said, "and you can tell me what the bloody hell you're doing and why, and why I shouldn't go straight back to Savannah and tell your father, if you feel like it." It was cold outside, and the sky lay low and heavy, the colour of lead. William felt the itch of Ben's eyes boring a hole between his shoulder blades. "This way," his cousin said abruptly, and he turned to see Ben push open the door to a large shed from which the warm, thick smell of smoke and grease floated out, surrounding them. Inside, the smell was stronger, but the air was warm, and William felt his hands tingle in gratitude. His fingers had been half frozen for days. The bodies of deer and sheep and pigs hung from the beams, streaks of fat showing grey and white through the slow drift of smoke from the trench below. Large gaps showed where meat had been taken away, to feed the officers occupying Wick House, he supposed, and wondered how Washington proposed to feed his troops through the winter. From his hasty appraisal of the camp building in the hollow, there must be nearly 10,000 men here, many more than he'd thought. "Adams said you resigned your commission." There was a creak and a thud as Ben shut the door. "Is that true?"
"It is."
He eyed his cousin and shifted his weight a little. He didn't have cause to suppose Ben would try to hit him, but the day was young. "Why?"
"None of your business,"
William replied bluntly.
"So Adam's still speaking to you, is he? Where is he, come to that?
In New York, with Clinton?" Ben jerked his head to the left. His face was pale in the grey light.
"Does it occur to you that you could get him in serious trouble talking to him? Arrested and court-martialed, even bloody hanged? Or does that consideration not weigh against your new loyalties?"
William's heart was still beating fast from the shock of finding Ben alive, and he was in no mood to mince words.
"How the fuck dare you?" William said, fury rising suddenly out of nowhere. "Never mind being a traitor. You're a fucking coward. You couldn't just change your coat and be straight about it. Oh, no. You had to pretend to be fucking dead and kill your father with grief. And what do you think your mother will feel when she hears it?"
Despite the dim light, he could see the blood rush into Ben's face and his hands clench into fists. Still, Ben kept his voice level.
"Think about it, Willie. Which would my father prefer? That I was dead or that I was a traitor? That would bloody kill him." "Or he'd kill you," William said brutally.
Ben stiffened but didn't reply.
"So what was it?" William asked. "Rank, General Bleeker?" "It can't have been money." "I don't expect you to understand," Ben said through his teeth.
He took a breath as though to continue, but then stopped, eyes narrowed.
"Or maybe you do.
Did you come here to join us?"
"What? Become Washington's bumlicker like you? No, I fucking didn't. I came to find Dotty. Imagine my surprise."
He made a contemptuous gesture toward the blue and buff uniform.
"Then why resign your commission?"
Ben looked him up and down, taking in the rough clothes and grubby linen, the thick boots with the woolen stocking tops turned down over them.
"And why the devil are you dressed like that?"
"I repeat, none of your business."
"It wasn't political, though," he added, and wondered briefly why he had.
"Well, it was political for me."
Ben took a deep, deliberate breath and leaned back against the door.
"Heard of a man called Payne, Thomas Payne?"
"No."
"He's a writer. That is, he was employed by His Majesty's Customs and Excise, but got sacked and started thinking about politics."
"As one does when unemployed, I suppose."
Ben gave him a quelling look.
"I met him in Philadelphia, in a tavern. I spoke with him. Thought he was interesting. Odd-looking cove, but intense, I suppose you'd say."
Ben inhaled too deeply and coughed.
William could feel the tickle of smoke in his own chest. Then later, when I was taken prisoner at the Brandywine, he cleared his throat. I had occasion to read his pamphlet. It's called Common Sense. And I talked with the officer with whom I boarded, and... well, it is common sense, damn it. He shrugged, then dropped his shoulders and looked defiantly at William. I became convinced that the Americans were in the right, that's all. And I couldn't in conscience fight on the side of tyranny any longer. You pompous twat. The urge to hit Ben was growing stronger. Let's get out of here. I don't want to go round smelling like a smoked ham, even if you don't mind. This argument, at least, struck some remainder of sense in Ben. They went out, and Ben led the way downhill, but away from the town. They collected a few looks from men carrying lumber toward the camp, but Ben ignored them. If you're a general, won't people wonder why you haven't got a flock of aides and toadies round you? William asked the back of Ben's neck, and was pleased to see it flush, despite the cold. It was perishing out. Snow had started to fall in thick, fast flakes that covered the dirty, frozen humps of earlier storms. That's why we're going where no one will see us, Bren said tersely, and stamped off down a trail of churned, cold-hardened mud toward a large shed near a frozen creek. It was padlocked, and it took Ben some minutes to open it, both the key and his hands being cold and uncooperative. Let me. William had kept his hands in his pockets, and while chilly, his fingers were still flexible. He took the keys from Ben and nudged him aside. What do the Continentals have that's worth locking up? He asked, though with no real intent to offend. Ben didn't answer, but pushed the door open, revealing the shadowy, long shapes of guns. Cannon, 4- and 6-pounders, 9 of them at a hasty count, and a couple of mortars lurking at the back. The Continental Artillery Park, apparently. The place smelled of cold metal, damp wood, and the ghosts of black powder. The smoke shed was a bit warmer, Ben observed, turning to face William. Let's finish whatever business we have before we freeze stiff. Agreed. William's breath came white, and he was already beginning to long for the company of the dead swine and their fire. I want Dottie to come with me back to Savannah. Surely you can see she needs food, warmth, her family. Ben snorted, his breath puffing from his nostrils like that of an angry bull. Bonne chance, he said. Hunter won't go because he's desperately needed here. She won't leave him. QED. In spite of Ben's obvious annoyance, there was something odd in his voice. Almost a longing, William thought, and the thought sparked the realization that had been slowly growing unnoticed in the back of his mind. Amaranthus, he said suddenly, and Ben flinched. He bloody flinched, the lousy poltroon. Does she even fucking know you're not dead? He asked. Yes, Ben said between his teeth. It's on account of her that I... never bloody mind. I can't make Dottie go, short of tying her up in a sack and loading her into a wagon. Do you think you... What's on account of your wife? Your wife. The words curled up in his stomach like worms, and he closed his hand, feeling rounded heat and slipperiness in his palm. Do you mean to say you told her what you were going to do, and she... I was a prisoner. I couldn't tell her anything. Not until... until it was done. Ben had been glaring at him, but at this looked away. I wrote to her then, of course. Told her what I'd done. She wasn't pleased, he added bleakly. Do tell, said William, with as much sarcasm as he could manage. Was it her idea to pretend you were dead? I can't say I blame her, if so. It was, Ben said stiffly. His eyes were still fixed on the open black mouth of a nearby cannon. She said that I couldn't let it be known that I was a traitor. Not just for her, or my father's sake. For Trevor's. Father would get over me being dead, especially if I died as a soldier. He'd never get over me being a traitor,
William finished helpfully.
No, he bloody wouldn't. And little Trev wouldn't have a good time of it as your heir either, once he was old enough to understand what people were saying about you. And him. You smeared your whole family with your excrement, haven't you?
He was suddenly warm, his blood rising. Shut up, Ben snapped. That's why I changed my name and had official word sent that I died, for God's sake.
I even went so far as to have a grave in Middlebrook Encampment marked with my name, should anyone come looking.
Someone did, William said, anger hot in his chest.
I did, you bastard. I dug up the body in that grave, in the middle of the night, in the fucking rain.
If you hadn't picked a thief to bury in your stead, you might have got away with it, damn you.
And I wish to God you had.
Underneath the anger was a sharp pain in his chest, just where the Hercules beetle had been, and Amaranthus's long, slim finger.
Your wife?
It's not your fucking business, Ben snarled, red in the face. Why couldn't you keep your nose out? And what about my wife? What the hell do you have to do with her?
You want to know?
William's voice came low and venomous, and he leaned toward Ben, fists clenched.
You want to know what I've had to do with her?
Ben hit him, hard, in the belly. He grabbed Ben by the arm and punched him in the nose. It broke with a satisfying crunch, and hot blood spurted over his knuckles. Ben was shorter and slighter, but he had the Grey's family inclination to fight like badgers and count the cost later. William crashed backward onto one of the big guns, Ben at his throat, and heard the blue coat rip as his cousin tried seriously to throttle him.
William was furious. Ben was insane.
With difficulty, William got a knee up between them and managed to break Ben's grip long enough to rabbit punch him in the back of the neck. Ben made a noise like a gut-shot panther and, lowering his head, butted William in the chest, knocking him over, then fell on him with both knees in William's stomach. They were crushed together, wrestling in the narrow space between two gun carriages, and William's knuckles were barked from hitting wood and metal as much from hitting Ben in the mouth. There was one moment when he caught sight of his cousin's face in a ray of light, when he truly believed that Ben meant to kill him. Then suddenly, the flurry of punches stopped, and the weight lifted. Ben was standing up, swaying over him, dripping blood, and William realized, through the days of fighting and the shadows of the cannon, that the light was coming through the open door of the shed, and there were voices.
A saboteur,
Ben rasped, and spat blood. It struck one of the cannon and dripped slowly down the cold iron curve, falling onto William's wrist.
Take him to the stockade. He's to speak to no one. Take him, I said.
William was not a fussy eater by any means, and the lukewarm beans and dry cornbread offered him after a very cold night in the stockade were ambrosia, and not too hard to chew, even with a sore jaw. It really was a stockade, though a small one, with a block containing half a dozen brick-built cells inside a palisade fence, and a guardhouse outside. There was no more than a 6-inch hole in the bricks to provide light and air, and the cell might have been sunk in a wintry sea, the air cold, dim, and damp, swirling with mist that seeped in from the outer world. He swiped the last bit of cornbread round his wooden trencher, and then licked the last of the bean juice off his fingers. He could have eaten 3 times as much, had it been available, but as it was, he washed it down with the quart of very small beer he'd been given, belched, tightened his belt, and sat down to wait on the wooden bench that composed the sole furniture of the cell. He had bruises and scrapes aplenty, and his ribs hurt him when he breathed, but he'd slept the night through from sheer exhaustion, and washed his face from a bucket this morning without flinching, though he'd had to break a solid 1/2 inch of ice on it first. The small injuries were nothing to bother him much, other than as a reminder of his cousin Ben. Logically, Ben should have William executed as a saboteur. This was obvious, as the only certain way to keep him from revealing the sordid truth about Brigadier Bleeker to Uncle Hal, Aunt Minerva, Ben's regiment, the London papers. Well, not the papers, no.
Letting it become an open scandal would, as he'd told Brigadier Bleeding Bleaker, destroy the whole family. He hadn't been overstating it when he told Ben that he'd get Adam into trouble either. Wait till Sir Henry found out that Adam had been conversing on the quiet with an enemy combatant. Because he would find out if they kept doing it. And the fact that said enemy was Adam's brother would just make it worse. If that was known, it would be assumed by everyone that Adam was a turncoat as well, passing information to his brother. He had a dim memory of his father telling him that a secret remained a secret only so long as just one person knew it. The memory came with a vision of a deep, deep lavender sky, and Venus, a bright jewel just above the horizon. That was it. They'd been lying on the quay at Mount Josiah, watching the stars come out while Monoke cleaned and grilled the fresh fish they had just caught. He breathed in nostalgically, half expecting to smell the dusty scent of flax and the mouth-watering richness of fish rolled in cornmeal and fried in butter. The lingering taste of the cornbread gave it to him for a moment before withdrawing and leaving him with the smell of the slop bucket in the corner of his cell. He got up and used it, then straightened his clothes and splashed another handful of water onto his face. The only thing he was sure of was that he wouldn't have to wait too long. Ben wouldn't dare keep him for long where people could become curious. "And you couldn't think of anything better than to call me a saboteur," he said aloud to his cousin. "That'll make everybody curious, you nit." William was curious, too, about what might happen next, but in fact not really worried that Ben would have him formally executed, much as he might like to. William's mind paused on the picture of Ben's face when Amaranthus had entered the conversation. Yes, he definitely had wanted to kill William right then, and undoubtedly still did. The thought of Amaranthus summoned her as though she stood before him physically, blue-grey eyes creasing with her smile, tall and buxom, smelling of grape leaves, with a faint sweet aroma of rice powder and baby poo, and her long, slender, water-cooled fingers touching his. He squared his shoulders and blew out his breath. Time enough to deal with her when he was out of this place. If Ben hadn't had him shot at dawn, he wasn't going to kill him. Aside from the fear that William would start shouting incriminating things on his way to the firing squad, there was Dotty. William had no doubt that she loved Ben and Adam and Henry. It was a close-knit family. But Dotty was fond of him too. And beyond that, she was a Quaker now. Having spent some time travelling with Rachel and Denzel Hunter, William had considerable respect for Quakers in general, and while Dotty was what he thought was called a professed friend rather than a born one, she certainly possessed enough native stubbornness to give any born Quaker a run for his or her money. He was therefore not surprised when a guard abruptly opened the door to his cell an hour later and Denzel Hunter walked in, his scuffed physician's bag in hand. "I trust I see thee well, friend," he said. His voice was pleasant, neutral, but his eyes were warm behind their spectacles. "How does thee do this morning?" "I've done better," William said with a glance at the door. "I'm sure a drink of brandy and a bit of Latin will fix me right up, though." "It's a bit early for brandy, but I'll do my best. Take off thy breeches and bend over the bench, please." "What?" "I mean to give thee a clyster to settle thy humours," Denzel said, jerking his head toward the door. "Of course, ice water is not the best medium for the purpose." He walked to the door and rapped sharply. "Friend Chesley, will thee fetch me a bucket of warm water, please?" "Warm water?" The guard had, of course, been standing just outside the door, listening. "Yes, sir, I suppose. You sure as you're safe in there with him, sir? Maybe you'd best step out here while I get the water." "No, friend, there is no danger," Denzel said, motioning William to lie down on the bench. "He is suffering from an injury to the head, among other things. I doubt he can stand." There was a scraping noise as Chesley unbolted the door and peered suspiciously in. William emitted a faint moan and swooned, one hand pressed to his brow, the other trailing off the bench in a languishing sort of way.
"Ah," said Chesley,
and closed the door again. Footsteps crunched away.
"He didn't bolt it," William whispered, sitting up abruptly. "Shall I run for it now?"
"No, he wouldn't get far, and it's not necessary. Dotty is giving Benjamin his breakfast and convincing him that the best thing to do is to give orders for thee to be taken to General Washington's headquarters. That's the Ford House in Morristown. I am meant to be administering smallpox inoculations at the church this afternoon. I will therefore insist upon accompanying thee to Washington to support thee in thy infirmity."
Here he paused to look William over, grinned briefly, and shook his head.
"Thee looks convincingly battered. I think thee might suffer an effusion of blood to the brain and unfortunately die as a result before we reach the general."
"A fine physician you are," William said. "Ought I to have a fit and foam at the mouth to be convincing?"
"Moaning loudly and soiling thyself will be adequate, I think."
Chapter 105.
400 miles to think.
The roads were either half-frozen slush or knee-deep mud, and the trees held their brown sticky buds tight to their twigs, refusing to let a single leaf poke its tender head out into this inhospitable climate. Still, William could feel the restlessness of the air, a sense of something alive and wild moving in the air between the soft fat flakes of snow. After parting from Denzel in Morristown, he'd resisted the strong impulse to go to Mount Josiah when he reached Virginia. He didn't need solitude or contemplation now, though. The choice was clear enough, and all the thinking he needed to do could be done on horseback. He'd had nearly 400 miles and 3 weeks of riding to make up his mind, and it wasn't nearly long enough.
"Good thing I've got another 400 miles to think," he thought, grimly dismounting and picking up the horse's mud-clogged left fore.
Betsy had pulled up lame, and William hoped it was just a stone, and not a strain or a hairline crack in the bone. The thought of having to shoot her and leave her for the wolves and foxes was worse than the thought of walking for another 30 miles through ice and mud, but not by much. Betsy was an obliging horse, and let William squeeze her leg, feel his way down the cannon bone and gently work her pastern joint. So far, so good. His fingers burrowed through the frozen mud caked thick around the mare's hoof, his thumbs working into the frog, and there it was, a sharp stone wedged solid beneath the edge of her shoe.
"Good girl," he said, relief puffing out with his breath.
He got the stone out eventually and walked Betsy for a bit, but the mare seemed sound, and they resumed their usual pace, going as fast as the road allowed. Weary of thinking and hungry, William shoved all concerns, beyond reaching a village before nightfall, out of his head. He succeeded, and it wasn't until he'd looked after Betsy, eaten a decent supper, and retired to a fireless room and a cold, damp bed with a mattress stuffed with mouldy corn husks that he resumed his cogitations.
Who first?
Every day he'd gone back and forth in his mind, until his head buzzed and the road blurred before his eyes. He was going to have to talk to all of them, but whom should he tell first? By rights it should be Uncle Hal. Benjamin was his son, he had to know. But the thought of telling his uncle, of seeing realization wash over his haggard face, William had heard more than one English father declare fiercely that he should rather his son be dead than a coward or a traitor. How many of them really meant that, he wondered, and was Uncle Hal one of those who would? His strong urge was to go to his own father first, tell Papa everything, seek his advice, and... He smacked his fist into the squashy mattress. Whom was he trying to fool? He wanted to hand the burden of his knowledge over to Papa and let him tell Uncle Hal. Coward, he muttered, turning restlessly over. He'd gone to bed fully dressed, and in his greatcoat, only removing his boots and moving destroyed the fragile layer of warmth he'd managed to build up. Coward. Without his consciously making a choice, it had gradually become clear to him. And now, in this clammy, dark, fireless room smelling of frozen sweat and burnt meat, that word at last gave him his answer. Her. It had to be her. He tried telling himself that this was the fair thing to do. Amaranthus needed to know first that he'd discovered Ben in order to take whatever action she could to protect herself once the truth was known. But he'd had enough of lies and lying, and he'd be damned if he lied now to himself. She'd made a fool of him, and damn near dragged him into her web. He wanted to tell Amaranthus because he wanted to see the look on her face when he did. Decision made, he went to sleep and dreamed of beetles with tiny red eyes. William took his greatcoat off for the first time when he reached New Bern. It was raining, but it was a soft rain that smelled of spring, and his skin yearned for air and freshness, and his limbs for a good stretch. It would need to be a good deal warmer before he took much else off, but he did find an inn with a stable for Betsy, and once having seen to the horse's needs, he walked down to the shore, shucked his boots and filthy stockings with a sigh of relief, and walked out onto the cold, wet sand above the tide. It was twilight, and there was no one on the beach here, though he could smell a wood fire and boiling crabs from a distant cluster of shacks. His belly rumbled. "I must be thawing out," he said aloud, his voice sounding rough and cracked to his ears. He hadn't consciously thought of food since recovering from the bang on the head in Morristown. Denzel Hunter had fed him then, insisting he eat something before setting out on the road home. He had tried to refuse, knowing that it was likely Denzel's entire ration for the day, but hunger and Hunter's insistence had won out. He'd eaten now and then, of course, on his way south, but without much noticing what. He wished he'd been able to persuade the Hunters to come back with him, but at least Dotty had written a letter for her parents. He touched the inner pocket of his coat and was reassured by the crackle of paper. The wind had dropped, and there was no sound but the soft hiss of the tide coming in. Thought of Dotty's letter brought Uncle Hal to mind, not that he'd been far distant. The feel of sand underfoot and the sight of his own footprints, long and high-arched, like a series of commas following down the beach, brought back again that conversation by the marsh and Savannah. Treason. At least there are no bloody alligators, he muttered, but looked over his shoulder by reflex, then snorted and laughed at himself. What with one thing and another, he'd given the quandary of his earldom not a single thought in weeks, and realized with some surprise that he felt at peace with himself and was reluctant to pick that burden up again. He didn't care who he was, but he wasn't the Earl of Ellesmere. He'd have to do something about that, but not now. At least Amaranthus's suggestion is right out. Not, he assured himself, that he would have taken her up on it in any case, but knowing that her husband was still alive quashed the notion out of hand. The hand in question closed involuntarily, wet with rain, and he rubbed his fingers against his palm, erasing the memory of the kiss she'd left there, with a tiny warm touch from the tip of her tongue. Damn, Ben! Selfish sod. A sudden rush of seawater surged up about his ankles, the cold running through his body like the electric shock from a Leyden jar, the water sucking the sand from under his feet. He staggered back, blinking rain from his lashes, and realizing that his shirt was damp and the shoulders of his jacket wet. A lift of the air brought him once more the smell of food, and he left the beach, his footprints disappearing behind him as the tide came in. Chapter 106. The High Ground, Kings Mountain, Tennessee County, April 1780. Taking possession of the high ground was one of the cornerstones of military strategy. Jamie's dad had told him that once, when he and Murta had sat up late before the fire, drinking whiskey and talking. Jamie had been hunched up on the floor in a corner with the dogs, hoping to be overlooked so he could stay and listen. Neither man was unobservant, though, and they'd spotted him soon enough. But by then they'd had a few drams, and so his Da had let him stay, now curled up next to Da on the settle, warmed by the fire and the heat of his father's solid body, the big hand that wasn't holding a whiskey glass resting absently on Jamie's back.
"You remember hiding in the bracken?" Murto was saying, his eyes glinting with memory. "Up on the hillside, waiting for the start of it."
A small rumble of laughter under his father's ribs had tickled Jamie's ear.
"I remember you standing up to piss and Enoch Grant behind you, poking you in the ass with the end of his bow and hissing like a snake through his teeth to make you sit down again."
"Not that you did sit yourself down," Da added, fairly. Murta had made a disgruntled humph, and Jamie had ventured to ask what he'd done instead then. The result was another louder mmm, and his Da laughed again, out loud this time.
"He turned round and pissed on Enoch Grant, and then jumped down his throat and gave him Laldi with the hilt of his dirk."
"Mmm," said Murta, clearly relishing the memory. The hapless Grant had escaped worse injury, though, because just then the officers started shouting, and the enemy, visible on the field at Sheriff Muir these last 2 hours, began to move. And a few minutes later we popped out of the bracken like a swarm of Brovedon, and the archers fired their arrows, and those of us with swords and targes ran down upon the Sassenach, Da said to Jamie.
"Aye, much good having the high ground did us," Murta said, glowering slightly. "A near as breakfast got an arrow in the back from our own men. It went through the sleeve of my shirt."
"Well, you did piss on Enoch Grant," Da said reasonably. "What would you expect him to do?"
Jamie smiled to himself, hearing the two of them talking, clear as day, and feeling in his bones the memory of the comfort of sleep coming for him, wrapped in the warmth of the firelit room at Lallybroch. He was warm now, sweating from the climb, and he wasn't sleepy. It was a small mountain, not even half the height of a Scottish Ben, but the sides were steep and thickly forested. He was following a cattle track across the face of the mountain. The local people grazed their stock sometimes on the top of the mountain because there was a good meadow, but oak and maple saplings and a scurf of low bushes were creeping over it, and the track had vanished altogether by the time he made it to the summit through a screen of pines. He stood at the edge of a long meadow, growing in a sort of saddle-shaped depression. It was late in the afternoon by now, and several deer were grazing at the far end, close to the shelter of the trees. One or two lifted their heads and looked at him, but he was still, and they went back to their business among the growing shadows. There were rocky outcroppings near the edges of the plateau, not large ones, but for a single rifleman, a decent vantage point, if you could make it that far, and not be picked off struggling up the mountainside. Aye, he could see well enough what Patrick Ferguson would think. With plenty of ammunition and a well-armed band of militia, it would be a simple matter to hunker down near the edges and fire downhill at the attackers. Except, as Frank Randall had recounted it, this strategy would work only so long as the attackers were kept at a distance. Let them get too high, too close to the wee meadow, and Ferguson would switch to bayonet tactics at that point. But the problem was that the attackers who'd survived to get high enough and had eluded the bayonets would come over the edge with their weapons loaded and mow down the loyalists who were fighting with unloaded guns equipped with butcher knives for bayonets. According to the damned book, Ferguson had little experience in battle. He'd been shot in the elbow in the only battle he'd fought, and the wound had crippled him, and he'd not understood either the terrain or the character of the men who would be climbing that mountain. Randall hadn't mentioned it, but Jamie was sure that Ferguson would have been using his own patented breech-loading rifle. He'd always use it, being unable to load a regular gun with his crippled elbow. Strange to think of this man, this Ferguson, minding his own business somewhere just this minute, having no notion what was coming for him.
"But you know the same is coming for you."
A strange quivering ran down the backs of his legs, and he tensed his back and curled his fists to make it stop.
"Nay, I don't," he said defiantly to the shade of Frank Randall.
You've not been here. You won't be here. I'm no going to believe you just because you wrote it down, aye?
He'd spoken aloud, and the deer had vanished like smoke, leaving him alone in the gathering twilight. The evening was peaceful, but not the meadow. He'd brought his own disturbance with him, and the wind made long rippling furrows through the grass, as though small creatures were being chased, running for their lives. There ought to be some ritual for facing one's death. And in fact, there were many, but none seemed quite appropriate for this situation. Lacking any other notion, though, he turned sunwise and walked the edge of the grass, making a circle completely round the mountain top and the shades of the battle to come. The first sun charm to come to his mind was the diesel charm, said to bless a new child and protect him from harm.
William.
Of course it would be William, always there in the back of his mind, the inner chambers of his heart. This might be the only thing of value that he could leave this child of his, and he let the prayer fill his heart as he said it aloud.
Wisdom of serpent be thine, wisdom of raven be thine, wisdom of valiant eagle, voice of swan be thine, voice of honey be thine, voice of the sun of the stars, scene of the fairy woman be thine, scene of the elf dart be thine, scene of the red dog be thine, bounty of sea be thine, bounty of land be thine, bounty of the Father of Heaven. Be each day glad for thee, no day ill for thee, a life joyful, satisfied.
It was only as he left the mountain top and started the slippery, rocky, awkward descent through the fluttering new leaves of the sugar maples that it occurred to him how much of that blessing had, in fact, been his. Had one of his parents said this charm for him when he was small? A life joyful, satisfied, he murmured to himself, and let peace fill him. It wasn't until he reached the bottom of the mountain that he wondered whether, when he came to die, Da or his mother might be there to greet him.
Or maybe Myrta, he said,
and smiled at the thought. Part 5. Fly Away Home. Chapter 107. Away in a Manger, Fraser's Ridge. We had acquired 2 yearling heifers in the summer, one mostly white with black splotches, and the other mostly red with white splotches. Their names, according to Mandy, were Moo Moo and Pinky, but Jemmy had been browsing my Merck manual and had nicknamed them Leprosy and Rosacea. Jamie said practically that it scarcely mattered what they were called, as he'd never met a cow that would answer to its name in any case. He called them Ruach and Van, red and white in Gaelic. At the moment he was calling the red one something in Gaelic that I translated roughly as misbegotten daughter of a venomous caterpillar, but I supposed that I might be missing the finer shades. It's not her fault, I said reprovingly. He made a Scottish noise like a cement mixer and gritted his teeth. He had one arm inserted in Rosacea's backside up to the elbow, and his face in the flickering lantern light was as red as her hide. It truly wasn't the poor cow's fault. She'd been bred too young and was having a lot of trouble delivering her first calf. But I didn't blame him either. He'd been trying for a quarter of an hour to get hold of both feet so he could pull the calf out. But Rosie was skittish and kept swinging her rear end away. The calf's nose poked out now and then, nostrils flaring what I thought must be panic. I felt much the same way, but was fighting it down. I wanted to help, get my own much smaller hands into the cow and at least locate the hooves. I'd cut my right hand badly during the day, though, and couldn't countenance exposing a raw wound to what Jamie was handling at the moment.
Nicknagalk, he said, jerking back and shaking his hand.
In the scrum and poor light, he'd accidentally shoved his hand into the wrong orifice and was now flapping his arm to dislodge a coating of very wet, fresh manure. He caught sight of my face and pointed a slimy, menacing finger at me.
Laugh, and I'll rub your face in it, Sassenach.
I put my bandaged hand solemnly over my mouth, though I was quivering internally. He snorted, wiped his filthy hand on his shirt, and bent again to his labours, muttering execrations. Within moments, though, the execrations had turned to urgent prayers. He'd got the feet. I was praying myself. The poor cow had been in labour since the night before and was beginning to sway, her head hanging in exhaustion. That might help, if she was tired enough to relax. Jamie snatched up the rope bracelets he had made, essentially two small nooses joined by a common rope, and shoved them over the tiny hooves before they could slip out of his hand. Then was squatting behind Rosie, pulling for all he was worth. He stopped when the contraction eased, panting, resting his forehead against the cow's haunch. It was dark in the byre. It was a small cave with a gate across the front, and there was no light save a small oil lantern hung from a nail pounded into the rock. Even so, I saw the ripple of a new contraction start, and leaned toward Jamie, trying to will my own strength into him to help. He set his feet hard in the straw and pulled, making an inhuman noise of effort, and with a squashy sort of grawp, the calf slid out in a cascade of blood and slime. Jamie got up slowly. He was panting from the effort, face and clothes smeared dark with blood and manure, but his eyes never left the calf, and his face was alight with the same joy I felt as we watched the new mother, remarkably placid, considering recent events, sniff her new offspring, and then begin to lick it with long, rhythmic swipes of her tongue. "She'll be a good mother." For an instant I thought Jamie had said it, but he was facing me, looking surprised, and there was a faint movement behind me. I swung round with a small yelp and saw the man who had stepped soundlessly into the byre with us. "Who the hell?" I began, groping for a weapon, but Jamie had raised his hand in greeting to the man. "Mr. Cloudtree," he said, and paused to wipe his forearm across his blood-slimed face. "I trust we see you well, and your family." "They're well enough," the young man answered, keeping a wary eye on me and the wooden shovel I'd seized. "And since I got the chance, ma'am, I meant to thank you for it. For my babies, I mean." "Oh," I said, rather blankly. "Cloudtree." The pieces of memory fell into place around that name. The fecund smell of the byre, the swamp of blood and birth water, brought back that night out of time in a small cabin, the endless effort, and the timeless forever when I held a small blue light in my hands, praying with heart and soul for it not to go out. I swallowed. "You're very welcome, Mr. Cloudtree," I said. "Aaron." That was the name of Agnes's nasty stepfather, Aaron Cloudtree. I eyed him with much less favour, but he didn't notice, his attention fixed on Jamie and the scene before us. "A nice bit of work there, man," he said to Jamie, nodding approvingly at Rosie and her calf, the latter looking round-eyed and bewildered, its hair swirled in all directions. "Near as good as your wife's." "Tank," Jamie said, and bent to pick up the grimy linen towel, wiping his face as he stood.
"What brings you to us at this time of night, Mr. Cloudtree?"
"I come earlier, but you was at table," Cloudtree said, shrugging. "You had the old witch there. I couldn't have spoke before her." Jamie glanced at me and settled himself, slowly wiping his hands.
"Speak now," he said.
"The old witch's son, Cunningham. You know he's been trading. Down to the Cherokee villages. Just the other side of the line." Jamie nodded, eyes fixed on Cloudtree's face. He was mixed blood, a handsome man with silky long brown hair, though with a petulant curve to his mouth.
"Not everybody listens to him," Cloudtree assured him, "but he's got some few men down there, maybe 20 will follow him. He calls them his militia, but he ain't fought Indians before, or he'd know better. They take his guns, his powder, and his medals, though. And they'd likely do what he asked, for a while."
"What is it that he's asking?"
Jamie had stopped wiping his hands and now held the towel twisted between them.
"I ain't heard this from him," Cloudtree said, leaning in and lowering his voice. "But I heard it from two of the men in Kiowi, ones he paid.
There's a red coat officer named Ferguson, set to go to and fro in the mountains, raising loyalist militias, and arresting rebels, hanging men and burning houses. Cunningham's wrote Ferguson a letter naming your name and saying he ought to come here with his troops, 'cause you a King Beaver amongst the rebels, and your pelt would be worth the trouble to take it. All the air seemed to have been sucked out of the byre. After a moment, though, Jamie took a long breath and let it out slowly.
"Do you know when?"
he asked calmly. Cloudtree shrugged.
"I don't know about Ferguson. Seems he's got plenty to keep him busy where he is. But Cunningham's got tired of waiting for an answer.
The men I talk to say he means to arrest you himself and take you to Ferguson, so's Ferguson can hang you for show, I mean. They say—" He looked at his hands and folded down the fingers, counting. 8 days from yesterday. Cunningham's waiting on a fella named of Partland, who's come in from 96 with some more men.
Jamie's eyes met mine, and I knew we were thinking the same thing. 7 nights from now was lodge night. If they were coming for Jamie, that would be the logical time to do it. It was a good 200 miles from the settlement of 96 to the ridge. But Partland and friends might well make it.
"That bloody snake," I said.
I was alarmed and angry, but anger was definitely on top.
"How dare he?"
"Well, I did take their guns away, Sassenach,"
Jamie said mildly.
"I told you they'd resent it."
He looked thoughtfully at Aaron and absently wiped the back of his hand across his mouth. He grimaced, rubbed the hand on his breeches, and spat into the straw.
"Aye," he said. "You've done me a service, Mr. Cloudtree, and I will remember it. Tell me, d'ye ken a man named Scotchy Cameron?"
Aaron had been looking around the byre, interested, but came to attention at that name.
"Everybody does,"
he said, switching the interest to Jamie.
"Indian superintendent, ain't he? Friend of yours?" "We've shared a pipe now and then. I was an Indian agent for a time."
I glanced at Jamie. I knew he'd smoked with the Cherokee when he visited with them. But I'd never asked him what sort of conversation this involved. I'd likewise never met Alexander Cameron, but like everybody else, knew of him. A Scotsman, he'd married and chosen to live among the Indians, hunting and trading. He'd become an Indian superintendent after Jamie's resignation, though, and as it was now widely known that Jamie was a rebel, he had therefore courteously not sought Scotchy out when he traded in the Cherokee lands. Cameron was still respected, though, Jamie said, trusted and known everywhere.
"Do you ken where he is just now?" Jamie asked.
Aaron pursed his lips, thinking.
Is he thinking where Cameron is, I wondered, or wondering what he can make out of the situation?
"Yes," he said,
though with a tinge of doubt in his voice. He scratched his head to assist thought.
"He lives with the Overhill people, but he was in Nensanyi last week, so he's likely come to Kiowi by now. That's where we live," he said, turning to me, "Susanna and the young'uns, and me."
He seemed to want to justify himself to me, possibly remembering, as I certainly did, his slapping Agnes on the night her mother gave birth. And he might be afraid of what Agnes had told me about him. "I'm glad to hear that you have a place," I said, smiling a little stiffly at him. "Do please give my regards to Susanna, and tell her that if she should ever need a doctor again, please send to me, and I'll come." His expression lightened, and he nodded to me.
"That's real good of you, missus. Do you want me to find Scotchy and tell him about this trouble of yours, sir?"
he added to Jamie, looking uncertain.
"Might be as he could talk sense to any of the Cherokee that have dealings with loyalists."
"I do,"
Jamie said. He gave the cows a quick look over, but the new calf had staggered to its feet, shaking its head. He nodded to himself, then bent and picked up the filthy towel he'd been using.
"Come down to the house, will you, Mr. Cloudtree? My wife will find you something to eat while I write a wee word for Scotchy. We can find a bed for you too, if you like."
Cloudtree shook his head.
"I like to walk in the night," he said simply. "It talks to me. But I wouldn't say no to a sup and a bite, missus."
I had come up to our bedroom, after providing Jamie and Mr. Cloudtree with a plate of rolls stuffed with cheese and my backwoods version of Branston pickle, but I was in no mood for sleep. My backbone had gone cold at Aaron's story, and hadn't thawed a bit, though my innards were pulsing with an angry heat. I'd been trying to distract my mind by reading The Two Towers, which Jamie had left by the bed, but kept imagining Captain Cunningham as Shelob in a gold-laced hat, and wondering whether I might nickname my syringe Sting. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I muttered, putting the book aside and flouncing out of bed. The floor was cold underfoot, but I didn't care. I paced round the room like a dog in a kennel, fuming. I did realize that I was stoking my anger in order not to be overwhelmed by fright. But it was a losing battle. How the bloody hell was I going to look Elspeth Cunningham in the face? I was bound to see her on Sunday, if not before. Bunking off church wouldn't help. If she thought I was ill, she'd be round promptly to dose me. Did she know what the captain was up to? I wondered, stepping over Adso, who was stretched out on his side on the rag rug in front of the hearth, flattened in sleep. If she did, what might she do? Likely nothing. She'd warned me, after all. And I'd warned her. A burning stick broke in the hearth with a sharp crack, and sparks sprayed up in a tiny fountain. A few caught in the fire screen Bree had made, glowing red for an instant before dying. The cat twitched an ear, but remained unperturbed. I felt, rather than heard, the front door closing, a muffled vibration through the bones of the house. Aaron Cloudtree was gone. I pulled my wrapper close and went downstairs, leaving Adso to mind the fire. "Do you think this Scotchie can help?" I asked dubiously. Mr. Cloudtree had departed, full of whiskey and pickle, with a sealed note written in Gaelic and carefully unsigned in case of interception or indiscretion in his pocket. And we were sitting by the kitchen fire, sharing the rest of the whiskey, with a piece of the resting house around us. It was very late, perhaps 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, judging from the deep, chilly stillness of the air outside, but neither of us wanted to go to bed. "A dinner, Ken," Jamie admitted. He rubbed both hands over his face, then shook his head, leaving his hair rumpled and fly away, short hairs rising from his crown, red in the firelight. He yawned, blinked, and shook his head, more to dispel mental fog than to acknowledge onrushing sleep, I thought.
"It depends," he said, after a meditative sip. "Where is he? Who he can talk to? And whether he can still read the Gaelic," he added, with a rueful smile. "If not, we're nae worse off than before. If we're lucky, he may be moved to find out who Cunningham's been dealing with among the Cherokee, and maybe drop a word to the headman of that village."
I nodded, dubious. The Cherokee territory was a vast country with hundreds of villages. On the other hand, Jamie was well known there as the Indian agent before Scotchie, and I rather thought that while Charles Cunningham's accomplices might be familiar with some of the Cherokee headmen, Cunningham himself almost certainly wasn't. Alexander Duff and his son lived within a quarter mile of the Cunningham cabin, Donald McGillies within a stone's throw of the Duffs. Sandy Duff and Donald McGillies were Ardsmuir men wholly to be trusted, and I knew they'd been keeping an eye on the comings and goings over the treaty line. "What did you do with the rifles you took from Cunningham?" I asked, pouring another cup of hot milk and adding a drizzle of honey.
"Gave most of them to men I can trust."
"Speaking of that," he said, and yawned again. "Oh, God, I'll have to send word to the Overmountain men, though I canna reach them all in time. Sevier might come, though. He's the closest, and a solid man. And he doesna much like Indians." Chapter 108 Lodge Night. 7 days later. Jamie couldn't eat supper, though he hadn't eaten anything since the night before. His wame was closed as a knotted glove, and he didn't feel hungry. The lack of food sharpened his bones and cleared his head. He felt calm,
but as though he was standing behind a sheet of glass, watching himself.
Eh?
Claire had said something to him, and he hadn't heard. He made a brief gesture of apology, and she narrowed her eyes at him, not in annoyance, in concern.
It's fine, Sassenach, he assured her. Cunningham doesn't want me dead. The worst that can happen is that he takes me prisoner tonight.
What about what happens after that? She demanded. She was wound up tight as a new watch. He could see her wee gears spinning and smiled. One of her eyebrows went up and he leaned over and kissed it.
Dinner fashion, Ian. After that, the captain has a choice, doesn't he? Get me off the ridge, and good luck to him if that's his choice. Or try to take me over the line and through the Cherokee lands to get to Ferguson, wherever that poor bastard is now. And while Cunningham's friends have friends among the Cherokee, so do I. And if Aaron Cloudtree either found Scotchy Cameron or spoke of the matter to anyone else, and I'd wager my best stockings that he did, you can tell he's a blabbermouth, the captain might have a good deal more trouble in taking me anywhere than he might think.
Oh, good, she said, and the line between her brows eased a bit. So after you start a small war over the treaty line, the captain will just have to kill you all by himself. Jamie shrugged. He hadn't thought that far, but it didn't matter.
He can try.
She didn't look much less worried, but she smiled at him, despite herself. Seeing that made him want suddenly and urgently to have her, and it plainly showed on his face, for her smile deepened, though her sideways glance at the door convinced him that she wasn't going to let him bend her over the table and try to finish before wee Aggie came in.
After lodge, then,
he said, grinning at her. She took a deep breath and nodded. After lodge, she said, trying to sound as certain as he did. I was thumbing through my murk, roaming from pleural disorders and the use of thoracentesis to a gripping account of inflammation of the rectal mucosa. But while my cerebellum could be coaxed into a momentary distraction, my brainstem, spinal cord, and sacral nerves were having none of it. If I'd had a tail, it would have been pressed tight between my legs, and small jolts of something between electricity and nausea spurted unexpectedly through my abdomen. The girls knew that something was afoot. They'd been silent as mice at supper, gazing as though hypnotized at Jamie. I'd been likewise hypnotized, watching him dress afterward. I'd stayed to help clear the table, put away the remnants and aughts from the meal, and smother the fire in the kitchen hearth. And when I came up to our bedroom, I found him facing away from me on the far side of the room. He didn't turn round. I thought perhaps he hadn't heard me come in. His face was reflected in the window he stood in front of, but I could see that he wasn't looking at his reflection. He wasn't looking anywhere. His eyes were fixed and full of darkness, and his fingers moved swiftly, twitching buttons free, unwinding his neckcloth, loosening his breeches, all as though he was somewhere else, completely unaware of what his hands were doing. He was preparing to fight. His plaid lay on the bed, along with a clean shirt and his leather jerkin. He turned, presumably, to fetch it, and saw me. He looked blank, and then the life flowed back into him.
"You look as though you've seen a ghost, Sassenach," he said, in a voice that was almost normal. "I can have aged a bit, but surely it's no so bad as all that."
"You'd scare the devil himself," I said. I wasn't joking, and he knew it.
"I know," he said simply. "I was remembering how it was just before the charge. At Drumossie, folk were shouting, and I could see the Gunner Moor across the field, but that didn't mean anything. I was shedding my clothes because there was nothing left but draw my sword and run across the moor. I kent I'd never make it to the other side, and I didna care."
I couldn't speak. Neither did he, but went quietly about the business of washing, of putting on his clean sark and his belted plaid, and when he got to his feet, he smiled at me, though his eyes still held memories.
"Dinna fash, Sassenach. Cunningham wants to hand me over to Patrick Ferguson and take the credit. It's his best chance to make his name among the loyalist forces."
I nodded obediently,
knowing as well as he did that the motive for starting a fight often had nothing to do with how things turned out. He started for the door, then stopped, waiting for me. I came slowly to him, touched him. He hadn't put on his coat yet, and his arm was solid and warm through the cloth of his shirt. "Will it be today?" I blurted. Twice before, he'd left me on the edge of a battlefield, telling me that while the day might come that he and I would part, it wouldn't be today. And both times he'd been right. He cupped my cheek in one hand and looked at me for a long moment, and I knew he was fixing me in his memory, as I had just done to him.
"I dinna think so,"
he said at last soberly. His hand fell away, my cheek suddenly cool where he'd touched it.
"But I willna lie to you, Claire. I think it will be an evil night."
Lodge night, by custom, began roughly 2 hours after supper, to let everyone digest their food, finish their evening chores, and make their way from wherever they lived. Some homesteads were a good 5 or 6 miles from the meeting house. Jamie urgently wanted to arrive early, both to anticipate any ambush and to have a quiet keek around, in case Cunningham had thought to post men in the nearby woods. He didn't, though. He stopped at the stable to check the welfare of his kine, then paused by the pig pen and counted the shadowy, stertorous forms clustered in the straw, noting that the straw had best be changed this week. Then he walked slowly up the hill toward the meeting house. The weather had warmed abruptly and bats were flickering through the air between the trees, snatching insects too fast to see. Brianna had told him how they did it, and if he listened close, he thought he could sometimes catch their high-pitched cries, thin and sharp as broken glass. Tom MacLeod stepped out of the trees and fell into step beside him with a quiet, "MacDo." It gave him an odd feeling sometimes when one of his Ardsmuir men called him that. Memories of prison, the hard things, and they were hard, but also the fleeting, regular pulse of the kinship that had kept them alive and would bind them for life. And at the bottom of his heart, always, a faint sense of his father, the Black One, whose son he was.
"Pray for me, da,"
he whispered in Gaelic. He could hear men among the trees now, coming along the mountain trails in ones and twos and threes, recognised the voices. Macmillan, Airdrie, Wilson, Crombie, MacLean, MacConnach, two of the Lindsay brothers, Bobby Higgins coming up behind him. He smiled at thought of Bobby. Bobby was one of the 10 men he'd told about tonight. Bobby hadn't fought anyone save the occasional raccoon in some years, but he'd been a soldier and remembered how. And of the 10, for all he'd been an English soldier, Bobby Higgins was one of the men he would trust with his life. He wasn't given to vain regrets, but for a piercing instant he thought how different this night might be if he had young Ian by his side and Roger Mack, if he had Germain and Jeremiah too, waiting outside and ready to run for more help if it was needed.
"At least you won't get any of them killed."
He wasn't sure if that was his own thought or his father's voice, but it was a small comfort. The Crombies and Gilbride Macmillan were waiting outside the meeting house. So were several men he knew to be quiet loyalists. Maybe Cunningham's, maybe not. But they'd likely not lift a hand to save him, if that's what it came down to. He thought one or two of them looked at him oddly. But the light was dim through the oiled hides over the windows. He couldn't say for sure, and put the thought away. He made no move to go in yet. It was customary to have a wee blether outside before they settled down to business. He replied to conversation and laughed now and then, but caught no more than the barest sense of what was said to him. He could feel Cunningham, out in the dark trees behind his back, waiting.
"He wants to see how many men I have."
Jamie wanted to see how many men Cunningham had, and who they were. And to that end, Aidan Higgins was hiding in the brush beside the main trail that led to the meeting house from the western part of the ridge, and Murdo Lindsay up near the trail that led from the eastern part. If any Cherokee came to take part in tonight's doing, they'd come that way,
and God and Murdo willing, he'd hear about it in time to take action.
Chapter 109. De Profundis. My right hand was throbbing in time with my heartbeat. The cut across my palm had healed superficially, but it had been deep enough that the nerves in the dermis had been injured, and they woke every now and then to protest the insult. I turned the hand over, checking idly for swelling or the red streaks of belated blood poisoning, though I knew quite well that there was nothing of that kind. It's just that broken things always hurt longer than you think they will. Plainly, I wasn't going to sleep until, and unless, Jamie came home, more or less in one piece. I lit the small brazier in my surgery and fed the infant fire with hickory chips. Like a bloody vestal, I muttered to myself. But I did feel a slight comfort from the burgeoning light. I'd already checked and refurbished my field kit in case of emergency. It hung on its accustomed nail by the door. I'd put aside the Merck manual. I couldn't settle myself to read. Bluebell and Adso had both wandered into the surgery to keep me company. The dog was asleep under my chair, and Adso was draped over the counter, his big celadon eyes half closed, purring in brief spurts like a distant motorcycle being revved. "Thanks for small mercies," I said to him, just to break the silence. "At least Jamie will never break his neck riding a motorcycle." He might never do a lot of other things, too. I cut that thought off short, and reaching over the cat, started taking bottles and jars out of the cupboard in a determined sort of way. I might as well take inventory, throw out things that were too old to be pharmaceutically active, make a list of things we needed next time Jamie went, yes, he will too go, into town, and maybe grind a few things, if only for the sake of pretending I was grinding Charles Cunningham's face. Or maybe the King's. Bluebell's head came up suddenly, and she gave a small woof of warning. Adso instantly uncoiled and leapt on top of the tall cabinet where I kept bandages and my surgical implements. Clearly we had company. "It's too early," I said aloud. He'd left the house no more than an hour ago. Surely nothing could have happened yet. But my body was far ahead of my thoughts, and I had reached the front door before I completed that one. I hadn't barred it after Jamie left, but I had shot the mortised bolt lock, and opened it now with a sharp, decisive thunk. It didn't matter who had come to tell me what. I had to know. I was startled, but not truly surprised. "Elspeth," I said. I stepped back, feeling as though I did in a dream. "I had to come," she said. She was white as a ghost and looked exactly as I felt, shattered. "I know," I said automatically, adding, "Come in." "You know?" she said, and her voice held both doubt and the horror of realizing that there was no doubt left. I shut the door and turned away to go to my surgery, leaving her to follow as she liked. Once we were both inside the surgery, I dropped the heavy quilt that still served me as a door, sheltering us from the night. Bluey was on her feet just behind my knee and was growling in a low, menacing sort of way. She knew Elspeth and normally would have gone to her for a friendly sniff and pat. "Not tonight, Josephine," I thought, but said, "Leave off, dog. It's all right." "The hell it is," was written all over Bluebell's face. But she stopped growling and backed up slowly to the hearthrug where she lay down, but kept her hackles raised and a deeply suspicious gaze fixed on Elspeth, who didn't seem to notice. I waved Elspeth to one of the two chairs. Without asking, I took down the bottle of JF Special and filled two cups to their rims. Elspeth accepted hers but didn't drink immediately, though it was clear that she needed it. I didn't hesitate to take my own dose. "I thought I might pray with you," she said. "Fine," I said flatly. "There's nothing else we can do now, is there?" I drank, hoping against hope that I was right and that she hadn't come to tell me that her son had killed or captured my husband. But she hadn't. I could see as much through the firelight that painted her face with the illusion of health. She'd come to me in fear,
not pity. Her lean, weathered hands were both wrapped round her cup, and I thought that if she squeezed it much harder, the pewter would bend. "It hasn't happened yet?" I asked, and was surprised that I sounded almost casual. "I don't know." At last she raised the cup to her lips, still holding it in both hands. When she lowered it, she looked a little less rattled. She sat silent for a long moment, studying my face. For once, I wasn't bothered by the fact that I had a glass face. It might save explanations. It did. She'd been shaken and pale when she came in. Now she was stirred, and a flush had risen in her sunken cheeks. "How long has he known?" she asked. "Your husband?" "About a week," I said. "We found out by accident. I mean, none of your son's associates betrayed him." I wasn't sure why I offered her this scrap of charity. I suppose there wasn't anything left between us now but the memory of kindness. She nodded slowly and looked down into the smoky amber of the whiskey. I was surprised to realize that she too had the sort of face that didn't hide its owner's thoughts, and the realization restored a small part of my feelings for her. "We know everything," I said, quite gently. "And Jamie knows that the captain doesn't mean him immediate harm. He won't kill your son. Unless he has to." She looked up at me, a nerve twitching the corner of her mouth. "Unless he has to. Let me offer you the same assurance, Mrs. Fraser." "Claire," I said, "please." The surgery smelled of hickory smoke and healing herbs. "Do you know any good prayers suitable to the occasion?" Weapons were forbidden in Lodge, both in symbol of the members' Masonic ideals and more pragmatically to increase the chances of those ideals being upheld, at least for the hourly meeting. Nonetheless, Jamie had come in mid-afternoon to place a loaded pistol under a stone near the door, and he had cartridges and balls in his sporran, and Claire's best knife sheathed and tucked into the small of his back, the hilt hidden by his coat, and the tip of it tickling the crack of his arse. He didn't often wear his belted plaid to lodge, but was glad he'd taken the trouble tonight. It would keep him warm if he was taken prisoner and obliged to spend the night tied to a tree or locked up in someone's root cellar. And he had a ski and do in his belt in front, concealed by his Masonic apron, just in case.
"Kiamar Ahauer Feister."
Hiram Crombie looked just as usual, dour as a plate of pickled cabbage, and Jamie found that a comfort. Dissimulation was not one of Hiram's gifts, and if he'd known anything was afoot, he'd likely not have come tonight.
"Guma agis leit gutin,"
Jamie said, nodding to him.
"Well, and the same to you."
"Will I have a word with you after?" Hiram asked, still in the Gaelic.
"Aye, of course,"
Jamie answered him in the same tongue, and saw a couple of the non-Gaelic-speaking tenants glance at them. With a touch of suspicion, he wondered.
"Will it be to do with your wee brother, then?" he asked, changing to English,
and was pleased to see that hearing the tall tree referred to as his wee brother made the corner of Hiram's mouth quiver.
"Aye."
"Fine, then," Jamie said pleasantly, trying to ignore the beating of his heart.
"But ken a harich. I've said I will na let Frances be married before she's 16. And not then, if she doesna choose to."
Crombie shook his head briefly.
"It's nought to do with a lassie," he said, and went into the meeting house, followed by his kin and nearby friends.
And here the man himself came, with his two young lieutenants, them in half-dress uniform, and himself in pale linen breeches and a light grey cloak, with a slouch hat against the rain. Plain by his lights. Jamie caught the movement as Kenny Lindsay ducked his head to hide a smirk, but Jamie wasn't so sure.
Aye, it was possible that a sailor wouldn't think what sort of target he'd make in the dark, but it was also possible either that Cunningham hadn't thought that he might be a target, or that Cloudtree's news was wrong, and the ambush, if there was meant to be one, wasn't meant to be tonight.
Then Cunningham emerged into the fall of light from the open door,
saw Jamie and bowed to him.
"Worshipful master," he said.
"Captain,"
Jamie replied, and his heart thumped hard in his ears as he bowed, because Cunningham was no card player, and the truth was written in the narrowing of his eyes and the hardness of his mouth.
"A formal occasion, is it, then?"
He had a sudden mental picture of them squaring up to fight a duel in kilt cocked hat and their Masonic aprons. What would be the weapons, he wondered.
Cutlasses?
"Stand ready," he said casually to the men who stood with him. The meeting went well enough, outwardly. The ritual, the words of brotherhood, fellowship, idealism. But he thought the words rang hollow with a sense of ice among the men, covering their hearts, separating one from another, leaving all in the cold. Things felt easier when it came to business, the small things they did as a matter of community. A widow, unable to deal with her late husband's stock. A man who'd fallen through his own roof whilst repairing his chimney and broken both an arm and a leg. An old quarrel betwixt the MacDonalds and the Macquarries that had broken out in a fist fight at market day in Salisbury and had come home with them, still trailing clouds of ill will. Things that were not really the business of the lodge, but that should be brought up. Talk that Howard Nettles was having to do with a woman who kept shop at Beardsley's trading post, whose husband was a bargeman and spent weeks away from home.
"Is there anyone here who kens Nettles well enough to drop a word in his ear?" Jamie asked. "If it's Mrs. Appleton that's being talked about, I've seen her husband, and he'd make two of Howard."
A small murmur of humour ran through the room, and Geordie McNeil said he didn't ken Howard well enough to say what he needed to hear, but he did ken Howard's cousin, who lived in a wee settlement near the Blowing Rock, and he could have a word next time he passed that way.
"Aye, well enough," Jamie said, thinking that Claire's bees would enjoy hearing about this. "And we'll hope it's soon enough to save Howard's neck. Thank you, Geordie. Anything else before we start the beer?"
From the corner of his eye he saw Cunningham move suddenly, but then catch himself and subside.
"It'll be outside, then."
He took a deep breath and felt a distant burden start to beat in his blood. Hiram Crombie had brought the beer tonight, it being his turn. Skinflint he might be, all the fisher folk were, having lived in stark poverty all their lives, but he kent what was right, and the beer was good. Jamie wondered what was ado with wee Cyrus, but it didn't look urgent. On the far side of the room, Cunningham was talking about loyalty, about his service in the Royal Navy, about loyalty to the King. Jamie slowly got his feet under him. All right, there was nothing that prevented men talking of politics or religion outside of Lodge, but this was not quite far enough outside, and everyone knew it. Silence spread from the men who surrounded Cunningham. Jamie took note of their faces, and a coldness ran through the room like spreading frost as the others began to listen and hear what was being said. Then it stopped. Cunningham still stood, unmoving, save for his eyes, which took note in turn of each face in the room. Jamie had been listening intently, not so much for Cunningham's words, but composing answers to them. Then Jamie rose to his feet. His own words fell away, and others rose in their place.
"I will say but one thing to ye all, Aheridan, and that is not my own, but a thing said by our forefathers 400 years ago."
A faint stir broke the sense of ice, and men shifted on their stools, drawing themselves up to hear, glancing sideways to see how matters lay. It had been a long, a very long time since he'd read the Declaration of Arbroath, but they weren't words you'd forget.
"As long as but 100 of us remain alive, never will we on any conditions be brought under English rule. It is in truth, not for glory, nor riches, nor honours, that we are fighting."
He paused and looked Cunningham straight in the eyes.
"But for freedom, for that alone which no honest man gives up but with life itself."
He didn't wait for the deep rumble of response, but turned on his heel and went out the door as quick as he could, and broke into a run as soon as he was outside, knife in hand. There were three or four of them waiting for him, but they'd thought he'd talk on, and he caught them staring moon-faced in the light from the suddenly open door. He hit one in the jaw, shouldered another out of the way, and was into the wood before they could move. He heard the shouting and confusion as the men in the meeting house all tried either to get out or to punch each other. The moon wasn't up yet, and the woods were pitch dark, but he'd chosen a large boulder near a huge spruce for his hiding place, and had the pistol in his hand within moments. It was loaded and primed, but he didn't cock it yet. His heart was pounding in his ears as he slid through the brush. He daren't run in earshot of the meeting house. But he thought he heard Cunningham's quarter-deck roar. He was bellowing, "All hands!" And Jamie would have laughed if he'd had breath. His freedom, and probably his life, depended on two things now, and he had no control over either one. If Scotchy Cameron had got his note, and if he thought it was worth keeping the Cherokee from being involved in a fracas over the line, that was one thing. The other was whether John Sevier had been able to find Partland and his men at 96 and stop them. Hiram Crombie and the rest were keeping Cunningham and his men busy from the sounds of it, but if either Cameron or Sevier had failed him, it was going to be a bloody night. It was well past midnight. I'd sent the girls and Bluebell up to bed 2 hours ago, and now exhaustion hung over the kitchen like a low veil of chimney smoke. We had exhausted everything: prayer, conversation, industry, food, milk, and chicory coffee. Elspeth didn't drink alcohol recreationally, pious Christian that she was, and had refused more than the one medicinal cup of whiskey tonight. While I longed to obliviate myself, I felt that I had to stay sober, had to be ready. For what? I didn't want to think. Thinking was another thing I had exhausted. For a time I had been conscious every moment of what might be happening at the meeting house. Visualizing the lodge meeting, or what I knew of it, for Jamie observed the Masonic vows of secrecy, and while he laughed with me over the apron and dagger, he said nothing about their rituals, wondering where the crisis would come. "Nothing will happen during the meeting, Sassenach," he said, in an effort to be reassuring. "Cunningham's an officer and a gentleman, and a Mason of the 33rd degree. He takes an oath seriously." "Such men are dangerous," I'd said, quoting Julius Caesar. I was striving for levity, but Jamie had just nodded soberly and taken the best of his pistols from its place above the mantelpiece. But now my mind was blank, having room only for a formless dread. I'd stirred up the fire. I stared into the flames, my face hot and my hands cold as ice, lying useless in my lap. "It's raining." Elspeth broke the silence, lifting her head at the sound of the spatter of raindrops against the closed shutters. We were sitting by the kitchen fire again, having left the surgery spick and span. Fresh bandages, linen towels, surgical instruments re-cleaned and sterilized, laid out on their own fresh towel on the counter. The brazier cleaned and filled with new hickory chips. A selection of quartery irons ready beside it. Without speaking a word to each other about what we were doing, we had prepared for sudden and dire emergency. "So it is." The silence fell again. The sound of the rain had rekindled my thoughts, though. Would it keep them inside the meeting house? "Nonsense, Beecham," my mind replied. "When has rain stopped a Highlander from doing anything whatever? Nor yet a naval officer, I suppose." "I'm sorry." Elspeth spoke abruptly, and I glanced at her, startled. Her hands were folded tight in her lap. Her face was pale and her lips pressed together as though sorry she'd spoken. "It's not your fault," I said automatically, and then more consciously, "nor mine." Her lips relaxed a little at that. "No," she said softly. She was silent for a bit, but I could see her throat working faintly as though she was arguing with herself about something. "What is it?" I said at last, very quietly. She looked at me, and I saw her stringy throat bob as she swallowed.
5 years, she blurted.
What?
She looked away, but then back, dark eyes fixed on mine with an odd look, apology mingled with something else. Relief? Triumph? When Simon died, my grandson, 2 years ago.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, I said,
and a lance of real fear stabbed me in the heart. Like everyone else present at the time, I'd been deeply moved by Charles Cunningham's maiden sermon and the story of his son's death and his last words. I'll see you again in 7 years.
What did you see? Elspeth asked, incredulous.
I flapped a hand at her in dismissal. If the captain believed his son's word, and very plainly he did, then he must conclude that he was essentially immortal for the intervening years. 5 years now.
Holy Lord, I said, finding a more acceptable interjection.
There was an inch of buttermilk left in my cup, and I tossed it back as though it were bad whiskey.
That, I mean, it doesn't mean that he will kill your husband, Elspeth said, leaning forward anxiously. Only that your husband will not kill him.
That must be a comfort to you. She flushed, embarrassed. Of course it was. She cleared her throat and tried to offer comfort, saying that Charles didn't mean to kill Jamie, only to take him prisoner and take him off to Patrick Ferguson to be hanged, I finished nastily, for the sake of his own bloody advancement.
For the sake of his king and his honour as an officer of that king, she snapped, glaring at me. Your husband is a pardoned traitor, and now he has forfeited the grace of that pardon. He has earned his own...
She realized what she was saying, what she plainly had been thinking, for quite some time, and her mouth snapped shut like a trap. The rain turned suddenly to hail, and hailstones beat upon the shutters with a sound like gunfire. We glanced at each other, but didn't speak. We couldn't have heard each other if we had. We sat for some time by the fire, our chairs side by side, not speaking. Two old witches, I thought, divided by loyalties and love, united in our fear. But even fear becomes exhausting after a time, and I found myself nodding, the fire making white shadows flicker through my closing eyelids. Elspeth's breathing roused me from my doze, a hoarse, rough sound, and she shifted suddenly, leaning forward with her elbows on her knees, her face buried in her hands. I reached across and touched her, and she took my hand, holding tight. Neither of us spoke. The hail had passed, the wind had dropped, the thunder and lightning had stopped, and the storm settled down to a heavy, soaking, endless rain. We waited, holding hands. Chapter 110. Confused noise and garments rolled in blood. Sometime later, time had ceased to have meaning by then, we heard them, the sounds of a body of men and horses trampling and the sounds of urgency. The noise had roused Fanny and Agnes. I heard their bare feet pattering down the stairs. I was at the door with no memory of getting there, fumbling with the mortise bolt. I hadn't barred the door when Elspeth came. I yanked the heavy door in as though it weighed nothing, and in the dark and flickering candlelight, I saw Jamie among a many-headed mass of black confusion, a head taller than his companions, and his eyes searching for me.
"Help me, Sassenach," he said,
and stumbled into the hall, lurching to one side and striking the wall. He didn't fall, but I saw the blood on his wet shirt, soaked and spreading. "Where?" I said urgently, seizing his arm and looking for the source of the blood. It was running down his arm beneath the sleeve of his jacket. His hand was wet with it. "Where are you hurt?"
"Not me,"
he said, chest heaving in the effort to breathe. He jerked his head backward.
"Hem."
"Charlie!" Elspeth's cry made me jerk round to see Tom MacLeod and Murdo Lindsay negotiating a makeshift stretcher composed of jackets strung on hastily lopped branches around the door jamb, trying not to drop or injure the contents. Said contents being Charles Cunningham in a noticeable state of disrepair.
They knew where the surgery was and proceeded there at a trot. Jamie pushed himself off the wall and called to them hoarsely in Gaelic, at which they immediately slowed down, walking almost on tiptoe.
"He's shot in the back, Sassenach," Jamie said to me. "Maybe a few other places."
His hand was trembling where it pressed against the wall, and his fingers left bloody smears. "Go and sit down in the kitchen," I said briefly. "Tell Fanny I said to get your clothes off and find out how bad it is, then come and tell me." The stretcher party had reached the surgery, and I rushed in behind them in time to superintend the moving of the captain onto my table. "Don't pick him up," I shouted, seeing them about to lay the stretcher on the floor. "Put the whole thing on the table." Cunningham was alive and more or less lucid. Elspeth was already on the other side of the table, and between us we cut his clothes off as gently as possible, she speaking reassuringly to him, though her hands were shaking badly. He'd been shot twice from the front, a ball in the right forearm that had broken the radius just above the wrist, and a shot that had scored his ribs on the left, but fortunately not entered the body. One side of his face was scratched and bruised, but from the presence of bark in some of the scratches, I thought he'd likely collided with a tree in the dark, rather than been in a fist fight with one. "Jamie says you've been shot in the back," I said, bending low to speak to him. "Can you tell me where the wound is? High? Low?"
"Low," he gasped. "Don't worry, Mother, it will be fine."
"Be quiet, Charles," she snapped. "Can you move your feet?" His face was dead white, beard stubble like a scatter of pepper across his skin. I had my hands under him, feeling my way between the jackets of the stretcher and the layers of his own clothes trapped under him. His clothes were sodden, but so were those of all the men. I could hear the dripping out in the hall as several men were crammed in the doorway, listening. I pulled one hand out from under him, gingerly, and looked at it. It was scarlet to the wrist. I glanced at his feet. One of them twitched, and Elspeth gasped. She was staunching the blood from his arm, but at this she stopped and bent over him. "Move the other, Charles," she said urgently.
"I am," he whispered.
His eyes were closed and water ran from his hair. I looked down at the table. Neither foot was moving. Fanny pushed her way through the men at the door and came in, her hair loose over her wrapper and her eyes huge. "Mr. Fraser has a bad cut from his right shoulder down across his chest," she told me. "It just missed his left nipple, though." "Well, that's a bit of good news," I said, repressing a mildly hysterical urge to laugh. "We put a compress on it," she assured me. "Agnes is pushing on it with both hands." "How fast is the blood soaking through?" I had my hands back under Captain Cunningham, feeling my way through layers of sopping cloth in search of the wound's exact location. "He's soaked the first compress, but the second one is doing better," she assured me. "He wants whiskey. Is that all right?" "Make him stand up," I said, reaching the waistband of the captain's breeches. "If he can stand upright for 30 seconds, he can have whiskey. If not, give him honey water and make him lie down flat on the floor, no matter what he says." "We've already been giving him honey water," she said, and looked closely at our patient. "Should the captain maybe have some too?" I had one hand on the captain's femoral artery. We'd cut his breeches, jacket, and shirt down the fronts and peeled the cloth away from his body, and the other underneath him. His pulse was surprisingly strong, which encouraged me. So did the fact that while blood was dripping off the table, it wasn't pulsing out into my hand. I thought the shot hadn't struck a major vessel. On the other hand, his feet still weren't moving. "Yes," I said, "bring some. Mrs. Cunningham can give it to him while I see about this." Elspeth laid her son's bandaged arm gently across his middle and smoothed the wet hair off his forehead, wiping his face with a towel. "You'll be all right, Charles," she said. She spoke gently now, but her voice was rock steady. "You'll be warm and dry in no time." I closed my eyes, the better to listen to what my hands were telling me. I found the wound in his back, and it wasn't good. A ball had entered between the last thoracic and first lumbar vertebrae. It still was between the vertebrae. I could feel it with my middle finger, a small hard lump, and stuck fast. It didn't move when I pushed it a little. The flesh of his back was hard and cold, the muscles all in spasm. He was shivering, though the room was quite warm. I told Elspeth to put a blanket over him, nodding at the vomit-yellow woolen coverlet folded neatly on top of the cabinet. The men who had brought him in were still in the hallways, talking in low voices. I recognized the voices. They were Jamie's trusted men. "Gilly," I called over my shoulder, and Gilbride Macmillan peered cautiously round the door jamb.
"Yes, here, my lady."
"Is anyone hurt? Beyond the captain and Jamie, I mean."
"Ach, it's nae more than a few bruises and cracked ribs, mistress. And I think it may be that Thomas has the broken nose."
I'd moved to the counter and was choosing my instruments, but was still thinking and talking at the same time. "What about the others? The men who were with the captain?" He lifted a shoulder but smiled, and I heard a brief laugh from someone in the hall. They'd won, I realized, and the adrenaline of victory was still holding them up.
"I could not see Ivana Weister, save that I broke a shovel over the head of Alistair MacLean, and there were knives and two or three who came to grief in the landslide, so..."
"The landslide?" I looked over my shoulder at him, startled, then shook my head. "Never mind. I'll hear about it later."
"They will have gone to my house." Elspeth spoke softly. "The wounded loyalists who didn't come here. I'll need to go and tend them."
She was holding her son's hand, though, fingers tightly laced with his, and her face was full of anguish when she looked at him. I nodded, my throat tight in sympathy. I didn't need to see the thoughts racing across her face to know what they were. Love and fear warring with duty. And I knew the deeper fear that was beginning to bloom within her. Her eyes were fixed on his bare feet, willing them to move.
"Gilly, go to the kitchen, will you, and fetch Agnes?"
He left, and I turned to Elspeth.
"He's not going to die," I said, low-voiced but firm. "I don't know if he'll walk again. He might not. The ball didn't go all the way through the spinal cord, but it's clearly done some damage. That might heal. I'm going to take the ball out and dress the wound, and when the swelling goes down and the bruising heals..." I made a small gesture, equivocating hope and doubt. She drew a long, quavering breath and nodded. "Stay while I take the ball out," I said, and reached to take her hand. "It won't take long, and you'll be sure he's alive." Chapter 111. Morning has broken. It was still raining, but the day was near. I made my way slowly toward the dim glow of the kitchen, not quite leaning on the walls as I passed, but letting my fingertips touch them now and then to make sure that I was where I thought I was. The house was still and smelled of blood and burnt things, but the air was cool and grey with coming dawn. The desk and chairs in Jamie's study a monochrome still life painted on the wall, and yet my fingertips passed through empty air as I walked past the doorway, my footsteps inaudible to my own ears as though I were the ghost who haunted this house. Most of the men had left for their own homes, but there were a few bodies on the floor of the parlour. I'd left Charles Cunningham sleeping on the table under the influence of a lot of laudanum, and Elspeth dozing in my surgery chair, head nodding on her neck like a dandelion. I wasn't going to wake her. The loyalist wounded would have to see to themselves. Or their wives would. In the kitchen, Fanny was sound asleep, sprawled face down on one of the wide benches, one leg dangling comically to the side. Bluebell was curled up below her, also sound asleep, and Jamie was on his back on the hearthrug, looking like a desecrated tomb effigy in the dying light of the fire. It was smoking and nearly out. No one had smoured it properly.
He opened his eyes at the sound of my footsteps and looked up at me, heavy-lidded but alert.
"Come and sit down, Sassenach,"
he murmured, and lifted a finger vaguely at a nearby stool.
"You look worse than I do."
"Not possible," I said. But I did sit down. Tiredness flooded up from the aching soles of my feet, closing my eyes as it rose through my body like a spring tide, filled with churning sand and fragments of sharp shell and seaweed. A warm hand curled round my ankle and rested there. "How do you feel?" I murmured. I did want to know, but was having trouble opening my eyes to look.
"I'll do. Hand me the wee jar, Sassenach."
The hand left my ankle and rose up to my lap, where I was holding the small jar of alcohol and sutures.
"I'll do it."
"You'll do what?" I opened my eyes and stared at him. "Stitch your own chest back together?"
"I thought that might wake you up."
He dropped his arm.
"Help me get up, Ian. I'm stiff as porridge on the third day, and I dinna want you to be crouching on the floor to stitch me. Besides, I might wake the wee lassie if you make me howl."
"Howl, forsooth," I said, rather cross. "Serve you right if I did. Let me see it at least before I try to get you on your feet." The floor around him was littered with wadded cloths, rusty with drying blood, and there were smears of it across a wide swath of floorboards. I slid gingerly down onto my knees beside him. "It smells like an abattoir in here." He smelled of blood and mud and smoke, but most strongly of the curdled sweat of violence. He put his head back, sighed, and closed his eyes, letting me look at his chest. The girls had put his wet plaid over him for warmth, and underneath was a folded linen towel soaked in water. A faint scent of lavender and meadow sweet drifted up, along with the sharp copper tang of fresh blood. I was surprised, and wondered which one of them had thought to use a wet compress to keep the edges of the wound moist. Whoever it was had also thought to take his shoes off and put the bundle of his rolled-up jacket and shirt under his feet to raise them. Or maybe Jamie had told them, I thought vaguely. Fanny's description of the wound had been completely accurate. It was a deep slash that ran downward from the middle of his right clavicle across the centre of his chest. I could see a faint shadow of white bone under the raw red scrape where the cutlass had almost touched his sternum and ended 2 inches below his left nipple, which demonstrated its resiliency by hardening into a tiny dark pink nub when I brushed it. By reflex, I touched the other one.
"They both work,"
he assured me, squinting down his chest.
"So does my cock, if you're reckoning such things."
"Glad to hear it." I picked up his wrist to check his pulse, though I could see it plainly in his neck, banging steadily along at a tranquil rate. The feel of him, warm and solid, was restoring my sense of my own body. I yawned suddenly without warning, and the rush of oxygen spiked my blood. I began to feel somewhat more alert. "That's going to hurt like the devil if you try to get up by yourself," I observed. Putting any pressure on his arms would tighten the severed muscles and skin.
"I know,"
he said, and immediately started trying to do it anyway. "And you'll make it bleed more," I added, putting a hand on his throat to stop him. "And you haven't an ounce of blood to spare, my lad. Stay," I said sternly, as though to a dog, and he laughed, or started to. He went white, well, whiter, and stopped breathing for a moment. "See," I said, and got awkwardly to my feet.
"Don't laugh. I'll be back."
I was moving much better on my way back to the surgery, my head clearing and my brain beginning to work again. Aside from the impressive knife wound across his chest, he seemed uninjured. No signs of shock or disorientation, and the wound was clean. That was good. Elspeth was still sitting in my surgery chair, but she was awake. My Merck manual lay open on her lap. I stopped dead in the doorway, but she'd heard me coming. She looked up at me, the skin of her face white and stretched so tight across her bones that I could plainly see what she'd look like dead.
"Where did you get this?"
she whispered, one hand spread across the page as though to hide it. I could see the words spinal cord injuries at the top of the page. My daughter brought it to me from Scotland, I said, improvising out of a momentary panic. But then I remembered. I'd destroyed the copyright page. No one outside the family knew or could know. And I breathed again. I can ask Fanny to copy out some of the passages for you, if you like. Though I don't know how much use they might be, I added reluctantly. Some of the procedures they mentioned just aren't available in the colonies, nor yet in most of Europe. I crossed my fingers under my apron, thinking, nor anywhere else in the world. And even as advanced as some of the things mentioned there are, they might not be useful to your particular concerns. I looked at Charles Cunningham as I said this, and wanted to cross my fingers again, for luck this time. Instead, I drifted to the foot of the table and gently lifted the bottom of the vomit-yellow coverlet to expose his bare feet. They looked perfectly normal. But of course they would, even if his spinal cord hadn't been severed, and I didn't think it had. It had clearly been compressed and damaged to some extent, and spinal cord injuries were often permanent. But it would take a little time for the visible effects, wasting of muscles, twisting of limbs, to become apparent. A sharp stink made my nostrils twitch and compress. Loss of bowel and bladder control. Expected, but not good. Have you seen anyone like this before? Elspeth's voice was sharp, and she rose to her feet as though drawn to defend her son. Yes, I said. And she heard everything in my voice and sat down again, as though she too had been shot in the back. Jesus, who shot him? Please, God, don't let it have been Jamie. I pushed back the coverlet and cleaned him gently with a wet cloth. He was unconscious and didn't stir. Nothing stirred under my hands, and my lips tightened. Men have very little conscious control over their erectile responses, as Jamie had just demonstrated to me, and I'd had a lot of men with quite severe wounds stiffen at my touch. Not this one. Still, it might be the laudanum. That really did affect libidinal response. I held on to that minuscule shred of hope for the moment and covered the captain again. Elspeth was sitting upright now, but her attention was inward, and I knew she was envisioning the same things I was, caring for a beloved child for whom there was no real hope. Her last child. Months, years, 5 years, came the searing thought of wiping his arse and changing his sheets, moving his dead legs 4 times a day to prevent atrophy, of dealing with the bitterness of a man who had lost his life but had not died. There was light behind the shutters now, though it was pale and watery. The sound of the rain had settled to the steady drumming of an all-day downpour. I walked behind Elspeth and opened the shutters, then cracked the window enough to bring a waft of cold, clean, damp air into the room. I had to go and see to Jamie. There was nothing more I could do here. I turned and put my hands on Elspeth's shoulders and felt her bones hard and brittle under the black of her shawl. He'll be able to talk and to feed himself, I said. Beyond that, time will tell. It always does, she said, her voice colourless as the rain. Chapter 112.